So I'm very happy to be introducing you tonight and indeed next week to two of the two great founders of Western philosophy. We've got them, unfortunately, in the wrong order, which is not a very good advertisement for us, is it? But anyway, never mind that. We start tonight with Aristotle, and Aristotle is going to be introduced to us by a fellow of the college, Pauline Sliwa, who is a philosopher here in Cambridge, and herself thinks about ethics mainly, and is going to be talking to you about Aristotle's great book on ethics.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's really glad to be here. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, and it's particularly a pleasure for me to talk about this because it's a book that I personally really, really love. I never studied it as an undergraduate, and then, so you can say I came to Aristotle shockingly late in my academic career. And I read it the first time, remember, I read the Nicomachean Ethics when I was on the plane to Boston. And I kind of took it, you know, the way you take really ambitious reading with you on the plane, because you're hoping that the lack of Wi-Fi will magically lengthen your attention span. And I think I didn't quite expect to be so drawn into it as I was. I literally could not put it down. And it was just such an inspiring read. You just felt like at every page, at every paragraph, there were just amazing ideas, and ideas that were really relevant and that kind of relate in a lot of ways to the way we still think about ethics, and just really kind of astute observations about moral psychology and how we make moral decisions. So if you haven't picked it up yet, I highly recommend actually going and reading it. It really is a very good read. Okay, so here's how I'm going to proceed. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background on Aristotle first. And in particular, it's going to be helpful to familiarize ourselves not just with his, biological, biographical background, but also with his intellectual background. And he was a student of Plato, so we'll talk a little bit about this. So you'll already be prepared for the next great lecture. And then I'll say a little bit about the Nicomachean Ethics. What I thought we'll do, rather than kind of me just giving you a summary of everything that goes on, is I thought that we would take the first book that's been very, very influential, and we'll just give the argument actually a fairly close read. So I've pulled out a couple of representative quotes, and we'll just kind of have a close look at what he's doing and what the argument is. And then at the end, I'll say a little bit more about what else happens in the Nicomachean Ethics. And if there's still time, I'll talk a little bit about how Aristotelian ethics still relates to the kind of ethics that we do today in philosophy. I couldn't hope to give you an overview of how Aristotle kind of bears on thought or like our civilization or our way of thinking in general, because I think Jonathan Barnes said that pretty much Western civilization pretty much is just like reception of Aristotle. That's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much, I think. Okay, so let's just start with, let me just master the...
slideshow.
Oh, where is it?
Right.
So he was born in 384 BC in Stagira, I don't know how you pronounce it probably, Chalkidice, which is in present-day Macedonia. And he was born his father died when he was quite young. His father was a doctor. He came from a pretty wealthy background, as you would have to in order to pursue the kind of life that he was pursuing back in the day. So when he was 18, he was sent to Athens, where he joined Plato's Academy. And he stayed there until Plato's death, when Aristotle was roughly age 37. And then after Plato's death, things are a little bit patchy as to what he was doing. He was traveling around, he got married, he had a daughter, then his wife died, then he remarried, he had a son, and his son was called Nicomachus, so it's after his son that the Nicomachean Ethics are named. During his time away, he spent some time tutoring Alexander the Great at the request of his father, which is a fact that a lot of you might have come across about Aristotle. And I think it's from this time that the statue dates. So as you can see, he looks very kind of earnest and stereotypically philosophical on that statue. But apparently, he was quite a dandy. So descriptions say that he was wearing his hair fashionably short, he was wearing lots of rings on his fingers, and he had good style. So there you go. Then he returned to Athens, where he founded the second university of all times, I guess, I assume. And while he was there, I mean, throughout his life, he was, I think saying that he was a prolific scholar is a bit of an understatement. I mean, he just studied everything and anything. He published probably around 200 treatises, and they ranged in topics from poetry to mathematics to logic, zoology, rhetoric, biology, marine biology, ethics, you know. You name it, he wrote on it. That seems to be pretty much the takeaway. Unfortunately, of all these works, not that many survived. So we're left with about 31 is the official count. And a lot of the ones that did survive, they weren't by him intended for public consumption. They're just accumulations of lecture notes or notes to himself. So they're not. Not all of them that we also know as one piece of work actually were originally a piece of work. So there's some debate as to whether the Nicomachean Ethics, whether they were all kind of intended to. So you'll notice that the Nicomachean Ethics consists of several books, and there's some debate as to whether they were intended as a unified work or whether they were after Aristotle's death somewhere. Okay, and then he died 322 in Chalcis, so he left Athens again before his death. Okay, so much about the man. So I thought the second thing that would be helpful is to just kind of brush up on our knowledge of Plato, so that we see what kind of where Aristotle was coming from. As I already said, Aristotle spent a very significant amount of time as a student of Plato's, and kind of as such, a lot of his work and the ideas in his work are kind of responding to Plato or criticizing Plato or kind of reacting to it. So I think a lot of his ideas and his arguments, even in the Nicomachean Ethics, make more sense when you know a little bit of kind of where he was coming from. Okay, so if there's one thing you know about Plato, what is it? One idea.
Right.
Yeah, the caves. So, what was up with the caves? Do you remember? Whoever said that, you regret it now?
What were the forms?
Yeah, so there were the forms, right? Okay, so kind of the distinctive feature of kind of Plato's metaphysics was that we distinguish between those two completely different realms, right? There's the realm of abstract objects, that's the forms, and of those we only have incomplete knowledge. And then there's the world kind of our senses, and when we perceive something, when we perceive beauty, that's like related to the ideal form of beauty, but it's only a very kind of imperfect image. Right, so that's kind of what the cave analogy is getting at. We perceive the forms, you know, as if we were seated in the cave or in Mong Hall and, you know, observe just shadows on the projector. So that's the basic idea. Okay, and so that's like a core commitment for Plato, and then a lot of Plato's philosophy, even his ethics, kind of is built on that idea. It makes Plato something of, you know, what present day you would call like a rationalist, someone who thinks that there's this realm of, roughly speaking, there's this realm of abstract object, and we have kind of special access to it by pure philosophical reflection. And experiences is something that tends to get in the way of perceiving the true and the good and the right. Okay, so that's kind of one of Plato's essential metaphysical commitment. Another feature kind of Plato, which is interesting to know when you look at Aristotle, is Plato's works are just literary masterpieces, right? I mean, Plato's prose is just beautiful, it's mellifluous, the dialogues are just these perfectly crafted pieces of literature. Okay, and when we come to look at Aristotle, it will turn out that Aristotle departs from Plato on all of these parts. He departs from him on metaphysics, on methodology, as well as on style. So, as far as the style is concerned, you know, here's what an ancient critic had to say about Aristotle's writings. He surrounds the difficulty of his subject with the obscurity of his language, and thus avoids reputation, producing darkness like a squid, in order to make himself harder to capture. So, I'm not sure that's really quite fair. I mean, I would be curious to see what this critic would have had to say if he was slugging through Kant's prose. But, you know, certainly if you if you're used to Plato's kind of literary style and his like well-crafted dialogues, Aristotle certainly is a little bit blunt by comparison, and there's a lot of technical language in Aristotle. Some of it is introduced, some of it is not. I think in part also because we often don't have the complete work, so we're kind of thrust in the middle. So I think in part this criticism isn't entirely fair, because, you know, if you're reading lecture notes, it's not that surprising perhaps that they're not that well crafted. Having said that, Aristotle did think that philosopher's job was to just kind of shoot it straight. So he thought everything, it was a waste of time, you know, thinking too much about writing itself. Okay, this is just kind of a brief aside. Okay, so I think more interesting is the difference between Aristotle and Plato when it comes to method. So Aristotle is really interested in the natural world. And we've seen this from kind of the range of subjects that he has written on, you know. And I mean, again, it's a little bit dodgy to use kind of modern day labels on the ancients, but he's certainly like the style of his inquiry is kind of empiricist in spirit. So he thinks a good starting point for philosophical inquiry is our senses and what they tell us. And he thinks, you know, that's in part because why we're interested in doing philosophy. So as he says, you know, human beings began to do philosophy even as they do now because of wonder at first, because they wondered about the strange things right in front of them, and then later advancing little by little because they came to find greater things puzzling. So he really thinks, you know, it's the senses, it's kind of your confrontation with the real world that presents you with puzzles that you then try to make progress on. And it's really also the senses that are there for you to straighten things out. And kind of to some extent, in present philosophy, we call something like this, also called like reflective equilibrium, where, you know, you don't assume that everything that your senses are telling you or kind of all the common sense ideas that you have are right, but you think that they're roughly the right starting point, and then you kind of try to adjust little by little and try to see whether you can make progress on puzzles. So really, what's really nice, and that's definitely something that shines through the Nicomachean Ethics when you read it, is that Aristotle very much has like a can-do attitude to philosophy. You're like, you make progress by just setting out the problem, like thinking through what common sense tells you, noting the puzzles, and then you're setting to work. Okay, so we'll do that in a moment. We'll set to work in a little bit. But before we do that, just a little bit on Aristotle versus Plato and metaphysical commitments. So we've seen that Plato distinguished between those two sharply different realms of abstract object and kind of our senses. And Aristotle firmly rejects this kind of metaphysical dichotomy, as he would if he, you know, likes to be on board with what the senses tell us. He throws away the metaphysics, but he does think that there's something to a distinction, or that there's something in the vicinity that that is somewhat similar in spirit. So just as Plato distinguishes between the forms and kind of the world of the for sensory impressions, Aristotle distinguishes between form and matter. And so, so matter is just kind of the stuff that we're all made of. And then what form is a little bit trickier to spell out in Aristotle. So he does say that form and matter relate kind of like structure, like the sculpture in clay. So the clay is the matter and then the sculpture is the form. So there you have a sculpture of, I guess, an obesified David. But it's not quite just that. It's not quite as simple, because Aristotle also relates the form to something like an end, like a final cause. So we get this in his quote from his Physics. He says, "And since nature is twofold as matter and as form, the form is the end. Since all other things are for sake of the end, the form must be the cause in the sense of that for the sake of which." So that's a little dark, but I guess the idea is that form is not just, it's not just kind of the physical form, but it's also something like a function of that thing. And Aristotle, that's kind of something that comes through his biology, in his treatise on the soul, is the idea that things have their characteristic, their intrinsic function, and that function kind of is an organizing principle of the matter. So perhaps one way to say it then, so matter is the regular stuff, and form is the organizing principle. And the organizing principle is not just the way in which the stuff is physically arranged, but also kind of the end towards which it aims, or the purpose for which it is arranged. Okay, so we have kind of the idea of matter and function, form and function. Hold that thought in your mind, because that's something that will turn out to be important when we look at his ideas about ethics. Okay, so that gives us kind of a background to Aristotle the man, and a little bit background of where his ideas were coming from. So now let's have a look at the Nicomachean Ethics. Okay. And I suggest we just kind of in good, following good Aristotelian principles, you know, we just pull up our sleeves and just kind of delve in. Okay, so we're going to look at book one, which deals with happiness. Okay, and there Aristotle starts out with the question, what is the chief good? And he takes this to be the same question as the question, you know, what is the final end for human beings? What's their aim? What's their final aim? some end of the things we do, which we desire for its own sake, everything else being desired for the sake of this. And if we do not choose everything for the sake of something else, for at that rate the process would go on to infinity, so that our desires would be empty and vain. Clearly this must be the good and the chief good. Okay, so what you're seeing here is a very well-respected philosophical move. It's called the regress argument. So the idea is, you know, we always choose something. In general, we usually do something for something else's sake, but it can't be all, this can't go on kind of infinitely, because otherwise there would be kind of no end to it. So there must be some end. And once we figure out what that end is, we're going to have figured out what the chief good is. Okay, so that's kind of the strategy. Okay, so how do we proceed? Well, we proceed by looking at kind of, he considers certain possibilities, like, you know, could it be wealth? And he says, well, no, wealth is not something that we generally don't want to be wealthy just for the sake of it, perhaps with some very rare exceptions. He considers honor, he considers pleasure, but he decides that all of these really serve as a means to an end, and that end is happiness. Happiness is the only thing aimed at for its own sake, and not as a means to a further end. And second, so happiness is kind of intrinsically desired. And second of all, happiness is the only thing that all by itself makes life good living. So happiness is sufficient for a good life. Okay. So here is wealth is probably not going to be the thing that you'll regret on the deathbed. Okay. So what you might think now is, all right, Aristotle didn't, so you might think, did it really take Aristotle to point out that happiness is pretty good and that that's what you're aiming at? So you might think that's like that's just like a trivial observation. That's surely that's not a deep philosophical truth. So let me just say that common sense is pretty valuable, so, you know, noting that happiness is a good thing might not be, it's not necessarily worthless in the context of philosophical inquiry. But the second thing to note is that even Aristotle doesn't think that what he has so far established is revolutionary. In fact, here's what he says, to say that happiness is the chief good seems like a platitude, and a clearer account of what it is still needed. Okay, so clearly, you know, we haven't reached the end of the inquiry so far. This is just the starting point. We're like established that happiness is the chief good, so now kind of the philosophical meat is in figuring out what happiness is. Okay, and now it's here where this idea that I told you to hold in your mind, the idea that there's something like a function, comes handy for Aristotle. So he says, okay, so how are we going to figure out what happiness is? Well, he says, this might perhaps be given if we could first ascertain the function of man. For just as for a flute player, a sculptor, or any artist, and in general for all things that have a function or activity, the good and the well is thought to reside in the function, so would it seem to be for man if he has a function. Okay, so let's just take a step back here and think about the kind of notion of function that's at work here, right? So we've said that, so we've said, you know, function is something it's something like an organizing principle for Aristotle. And also as a final end. But we can now see that actually it plays a more substantive role than that, right? So first of all, what the function of something is kind of part of what makes it what it is, you know. So presumably, what makes a flute player a flute player is the fact that he plays a flute. So the function of the flute player is flute playing, and flute playing is also what makes him what he is, if you see what I mean. But second of all, it's also what makes him, it's a standard. So it's what makes him what it is, and also it's what serves as a standard for him. So playing flute is what makes a flute player a flute player. And insofar as he does it well, he's a good flute player, right? So how well you, so kind of flute playing is also a standard against which we judge the particular exemplar, the flute player, as to how good of an exemplar of a flute player he is. Okay, so so you can see how all of a sudden, from like a fairly innocuous idea that there is such a thing like a function, all of a sudden this idea is not so innocuous anymore. It's actually like a super substantive idea. In particular, once we move away from flute players and sculptors to something more general, like a human. So here the idea is we can look at what happiness is by identifying kind of the characteristic activity of a human, and then kind of looking how one performs this, what it is to perform this characteristic activity well. Right. So this is clearly like a super strong claim, right? I mean, even the idea that there is such a thing as a characteristic activity of a human, that's an extremely substantive philosophical claim. Okay, so, you can see that Aristotle, at least at this point, is hedging. He says, if there is such a thing as a function. Okay, so now we've got happiness as our chief good. We're trying to get a handle on what it is. We're going to get a handle on it by inquiring into the function of man. So now, our next step is kind of we're on the hunt for the function of man, and the function of man is related, just as the function of the flute player is the flute playing, we're looking for the characteristic activity that makes makes humans what they are. Well, yeah, so now we would say humans. I mean, Aristotle, obviously, in his time, you know, he thought it was literally just man. Okay, so we're asking, what is the proper function of human being? Okay, so how are we going to go about figuring out what it is? Well, here's what Aristotle does, is he kind of runs through, very much in the methodology of common sense, he runs through some obvious candidates, and then kind of hones in on something that seems the most plausible of the lot. Okay, so what sort of thing might it be? Okay, so the first... for living is obviously shared even by plants, while what we are looking for is something special to human beings, right? Okay, so we know why it needs to be special. It's because it's that in virtue of which human beings are human beings, right? So it needs to be something that sets human beings apart from all other things. Okay, so just living isn't going to cut it for that reason, because anything's alive, right? So that's not special enough. We should therefore rule out the life of nourishment and growth. Okay, so we got, because again, that's shared by plants. Okay, so next would be some sort of sentient life. Okay, so that's just the life of sensory perception. But this again is clearly shared by the horse, the ox, indeed by every animal. What remains is a life concerning in some way with action of the element that possesses reason. Okay, so we've honed in, we've gone from general being alive to sense perception, abandoned those, and now we've honed on philosophers' favorite aspect of humans, which is the capacity for like rational thought and reason. Okay, so, and here is where Aristotle concludes that, you know, if there is a function of man that's characteristic, it is going to be the rational activity of the soul. And, of course, insofar as it's good, it's going to be kind of doing that really, really well. So the human good turns out to be the activity of the soul in accordance with virtue. Okay, so that's where the argument from function has brought us. And in some ways, this really sets the stage for a lot of the inquiry, of the rest of the inquiry in the Nicomachean Ethics, because so far, you know, we've made a little bit of progress, right? We started out just with the observation that the chief good is happiness. Then we said, well, that's pretty trivial. Let's fill out that notion of happiness a little bit more. So we've used the argument from function. We've honed in on it being the on it via the characteristic activity of humans. And we said it's kind of being rational really, really well. It's the activity of the soul in accordance with virtue. And kind of now, of course, the rest of the project is to give a more substantive account of what that is. So as far as this book is concerned, Aristotle says a couple of things. So he says, first of all, you know, insofar as you exercise your rational capacities really, really well, this isn't just the thing that you do on one off because you're lucky. Rather, it proceeds from a firm and stable disposition. Because as it says, for one swallow does not make a summer, nor one day, neither does one day or a short time make someone blessed or happy. Okay? Okay, so we've seen that it's proceeds from a disposition. So now we can just kind of put the things together. So we've got argument from the nature of end that tells us that the good for humans is happiness. We've got the argument from function that tells us that the good for humans is rational activity. And this tells us that happiness is rational activity. Okay, so one thing to note is that that makes Aristotle something of a hedonist, right? Because we've got happiness as the final goal. But even with the sketchy account of happiness on the table so far, it's clear that Aristotelian hedonism is not the kind of hedonism that we think of when we think of hedonism. Incidentally, I was looking for an image to include on hedonism on the slide, but when you search for hedonism, Google Images just gives you images of porn. So Aristotle was definitely not that kind of. He was definitely not that kind of hedonist. Okay. So one thing that's really striking, I think it's interesting to just think a little bit about how his conception of hedonism differs from kind of contemporary hedonism, even contemporary philosophical hedonism. And kind of one clear way is that happiness for him is an activity, right? When you think of happiness, of the kind of happiness or pleasure that's put forward by modern hedonism, what kind of thing is it? It's not an activity, right? You guys, yeah. Cambridge like sucked out. Yes.
Something like a state or a feeling.
Yeah, it's a feeling, right? It's something momentary. It's a feel. It's an experience, right? And in philosophy, like the hedonism is someone who's on the quest for pleasure, where pleasure is understood as a subjective kind of state. A feeling of like a desire satisfaction or a feeling of pleasure. This is decidedly not the account of happiness that Aristotle gives us. According according to Aristotle, first of all, happiness is an activity. Second of all, it's an activity involving your exercise of your rational capacities. Does the present day hedonism aim at the exercise of their rational capacities? It seems not quite, right? If anything, a lot of kind of hedonistic pleasures are aimed at making sure that the rational capacities don't get in the way of having experiences that we'd like to have. Second of all, kind of happiness is an objective state for Aristotle. It's not a matter of how you feel. It's a matter of what you do and whether you do it correctly. And so for all these reasons, kind of the happiness that Aristotle calls this distinctive kind of happiness eudaimonia, and there are lots of translations of this, and in general, people who favor one translation think that all the other translations are awfully misguided. So one kind of way of translating it is something like flourishing. A lot of people don't like this because it makes it too much like plants, whereas for Aristotle, it's something more specific to rational capacities. But it's kind of it gets at the rough idea. Okay, and because it's an activity, how do we acquire it? Well, we can't just be passive about it, right? And again, the image that we started out with and the parallels that Aristotle draws are quite telling, right? So recall, again, the lyre player. So the lyre, what makes the lyre player a really good lyre player is that he plays the lyre very, very well. Well, how do you get to be a really, really good lyre player? Well, presumably you practice a lot, spend a lot of time playing the lyre. Okay, so the same Aristotle things is with virtue, and since kind of exercising your rational capacities and according with virtue just is happiness, the same is true with happiness. Happiness is something that's learned. It's learned through practice, in part he thinks it's learned through habituation. But it's something that it's not kind of a natural ability. And in that sense, it differs, really importantly, from the kind of capacities that animals have, like sensory capacities, which you just have naturally. Those ones you have to learn. Okay. All right, so that kind of takes us through the first book of Aristotle, of the Aristotelian, of the Nicomachean Ethics. And I've just kind of put up the subsequent topics that then Aristotle deals with, and you can see that the kind of discussion of happiness and of the relationship between happiness and virtue is kind of playing an important role and thread through all of them. There's a question about virtue and the mean, how virtue is acquired. He discusses voluntariness and responsibility because he's concerned with when do we deserve credit, praise, and blame for acting virtuously. He discusses justice. That's in part because he thinks that virtue is the kind of thing that you need to learn. Well, where do you learn it from? You learn it partly from perhaps your parents, but you also learn it from the community. And that means that the way in which the community is structured, in particular the kinds of laws that it has, play an important role in kind of forming you into being a virtuous person. And for Aristotle, in the ideal case, being virtuous is just being lawful. So the aim of the law is to make you a really virtuous person. But that might seem really strange then, when you think about some of the virtues that Aristotle considers to be virtuous, like he thinks being witty is a virtue. So you might think, isn't it a little bit strange to legislate wit? But then apparently I also learned that, in his politics, he has a very enthusiastic discussion about how flute playing should be legally regulated. So it might well be that Aristotle thought that the law even has to play a role in making people witty. Okay, and then there are other topics. So I'm just going to take the last couple of minutes just to kind of sketch out how some of the picture, I mean, I think we've got a broad picture of the methodology and the main ideas. And so I just want to take a couple of minutes at the end to sketch how that relates to kind of contemporary ethics, to how we think, kind of how we theorize about ethics in philosophy today. And so one thing to say is that kind of Aristotelian ethics was kind of in the background. I mean, obviously, Kant and all the other great thinkers knew their Aristotle, and they studied, and they were responding to it, and they incorporated a lot of the ideas and influences. But at least in the kind of last, you know, 60, 80 years, Aristotelian ethics was a little bit aside, and people were very much thinking in terms of you know, the two big approaches were kind of consequentialism, you know, the idea that to be good is a matter of maximizing happiness or maximizing utility, and kind of a deontological ethics, where the idea was, you know, kind of Kantian inspired. You follow the categorical imperative, so you do, you know, you perform those actions that are universalizable. Okay, so both of those approaches, what they have in common is that they think of morality as something that's very much governed by universal rules and principles. And it's something that relates to actions. So we assess after the primary assessment of ethics lies with actions. You know, either your action maximized utility or it didn't. If it did, it's right. If it didn't, it's wrong. Either your action was universalizable, you know, everyone could have acted as you did without any contradiction ensuing, or it didn't. If it did, it was, if it was universalizable, it was right, if it were permissible, if it wasn't, it was impermissible. Okay, but you can see that this is a very, like, the Aristotelian picture is a very, very different picture from that, right? It doesn't really tell you all that much about actions or what the right actions are. It's not, that's not its primary focus. Rather, it's kind of focused on character. It's focused on what it is to be virtuous. And then he doesn't have anything terribly enlightening to say about which particular actions are right and wrong. What he says is, you know, the measure of the right action is the virtuous man. So something is right if the virtuous person would have done it. But he doesn't say, he doesn't give you any kind of principle or unified guideline. And in fact, Aristotle repeatedly thinks, in part, I mean, this is not an accident, he thinks that ethics is just not the kind of subject matter where any such precise guidelines or principles or rules can be given. He says several times in the Nicomachean, it's an inexact science, you know, we have to proceed. So that's like a very different approach. And it's one that so it was a little bit on the side, and then Elizabeth Anscombe, was a professor here in Cambridge in the faculty for a while. She really brought Aristotelian ethics back with a very influential essay. And kind of ever since then, there has been quite a thriving program kind of thinking of contemporary research about thinking about virtue. And you can see why it's a fruitful research project is because, kind of unlike the two others, it actually connects very nicely with questions that psychologists are also interested in. You know, questions about kind of developmental psychology and questions about well-being and the nature of well-being and questions about how you get to be good. And kind of all of these are, there's been a very, very fruitful research project with lots of collaboration between philosophers and psychologists on these questions. So I guess this is just to say Aristotle is still alive. All right, thank you.